we're now going to move to the second part of this afternoon, and Guy is going to give his talk, and then hopefully the talk has generated a number of questions or points of view that you might want to bring up. So we've got plenty of time for discussion, and then we have the reception, which is downstairs in the student area at 6 o'clock. So hopefully you'll be able to either contribute here or discuss more informally with people who have gathered up. It's thank you, Guy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. So we've had the view from the present and the view from the past, and I've got the end here, the view from the future. But we're going to be looking at the future of death and ageing largely by extrapolating the past. So we'll go over some of the territory in relation to previous speakers. I've got this here because some of the arguments I'll be using are from my recent book, and I thought I'd get a plug in here very early because I'm bound to forget it later on. So I'm going to be talking about the future of death and ageing. So as you know, death is largely in retreat and has been for some time. So this is a plot by Open Liverpool of female life expectancy in that country that was at that time had the highest life expectancy against death. What we can see is that prior to 1800, no country had a life expectancy exceeding 40 years. But after about 1800, life expectancy started to rise at a rapid rate and surprisingly consistent rate of between 2 and 2.5 years per decade. So every decade you live, your life expectancy increases by between 2 and 2.5 years. That's 5 hours per day. The surprising thing is it continues to increase in that rate, even in the country of highest life expectancy, which is currently Japan, and there's absolutely no sign that that rate is slowing down. That's surprising because many different writers have predicted that this rate of increase would decrease as average life expectancy came towards maximum life expectancy. So there have been many different ideas in the past about where maximum life expectancy was, for example, 60 or 70 or 80 or 85. And as Open and Walpole point out, all of these expected maximums have been broken, which leads to the idea that humans do not have an absolute maximum lifespan. So the idea of a maximum lifespan is partly based on the idea that there's programmed ageing, that death and ageing kick in at a particular age, and there's nothing that we could do about it. But evolutionary biologists and a number of theoreticians about ageing reject that theory now, partly because in the natural state, as it were, humans before civilization died largely before they functionally aged to a significant extent. And most animals in the wild die before they significantly age due to extremes it causes, such as starvation or predation or infection or accidents or cold. So there was no evolutionary selection pressure driving ageing. In fact, the opposite of the case, there was no selection against ageing because in the wild, before civilizations, humans didn't significantly age. So there's no selection pressure against ageing. So this leads to the more generally accepted concept of ageing in terms of mechanism, that it's due to an accumulation of errors during our lifetime, and eventually we fail in some way because those errors have accumulated. It's not due to an intrinsic program, and therefore there's no intrinsic absolute maximum lifespan for humans. If we extrapolate this curve, it would go to 100 years in 2060 in the country of highest life expectancy, and it should reach that in this country by the end of this century. Of course, one result of that is an enormous increase in populations that are very aged. Currently, there are nearly 10,000 people in this country over the age of 100, an astonishing figure. At the beginning of the 20th century, there were a handful of people in this country over the age of 100. Apparently, it was about 100 in 1911. Now there are nearly 10,000. But because of the increase in longevity, this is the predicted change in the population over 100 by the government's actuaries department in 2007, predicting about 250,000 people over the age of 100 by 2050. Of course, the question is, is it a good thing to generate those populations? They are a kind of new type of human being that we're generating that hasn't really existed before. So we have the idea of the seven ages of man, which is particularly reflected in Shakespeare, with an idea of a maximum lifespan of 70. But nowadays we need to expand that because of the changes in longevity to something like the six phases of life. With the first, instead of decades, we have double decades of childhood, young adulthood, middle age, old age, and these various other fractions. The point is that what is regarded as old age has expanded into a vast territory which covers more than one phase of life. We tend to think of old age as something that happens to extrapolate from for most people, extrapolating from, you know, our parents or grandparents in the age of 6 through 18, we think that's what old age is. But actually we're generating populations that are much, much older than that, and they're covering different physiologies. We're talking about people in completely different phases of life. Of course, ageing is a very heterogeneous thing, but it also covers different phases of life, not just one phase of life. As Chris, I think, was talking about the Renaissance figures referring to old age, and what they may have been referring to is actually middle age being the new, old age being the new middle age. But the point is that old age is expanding dramatically, has expanded dramatically. So we even have people now greater than 120, so Jean Camon reached the age of 122 and a half. In 1997. Of course, the question is generating these type of people worthwhile, in a sense? Is it humane? So Jean Calment, during her last few years of life, had very poor sight, functionally blind, deaf, immobile, and very poor memory, although she wasn't demented. So the good news is that longevity has increased very dramatically. It's basically doubled for the whole world in the last 200 years. But the problem is that the rate of aging does not appear to have changed dramatically over that time period. So there's different ways of measuring the rate of aging, but one of the more robust ways to measure it is in terms of mortality doubling time. That is the time over which your probability of dying in the next year doubles. And Benjamin Gompert, at the beginning of the 19th century in the UK, pointed out that for human populations, the probability of dying doubles every roughly 8 years. And that fits best between the ages of about 30 and 80. And basically, if you plot the same thing today, it's virtually exactly the same doubling time of, in this case, for the US population, 8.6 years. So although the absolute mortality rates at any particular age have gone down dramatically, the way in which they change with age has changed very little at all. Now, and there's various other ways of measuring ageing which suggest that the rate of ageing hasn't changed much. Now, I should say that this question of whether the rate of ageing is in to some extent contentious, and it's difficult to measure. And in fact, it's something that requires much more research into it. But in gross terms, there appears to be no dramatic change in the rate of ageing over the last 200 years. Indeed, from archaeological samples and research, would indicate that the mortality doubling time has not changed over the last few thousand years. Which leads to the question of whether ageing is in fact natural. So ageing in wild animals is very rare because animals die from extrinsic reasons before they significantly age. And it would appear because, as I've said, in historical times, longevity averaged between 10 and 30, just going up to 40. So significant ageing was rare in the human population before the last 200 or 300 years. Of course, it depends what you refer to as ageing. But ageing is in part a product of the culture of a recent, it's a relatively recent thing in human history. So significant ageing was rare in humans and animals prior to the modern era because they died from extrinsic causes prior to significant ageing. Thus, ageing is not natural but rather a product of culture caused by removing the causes of premature death. So people used to die young. So this is a plot of the percentage of deaths in different age groups. And this data comes from the Elizabethan age in London, from the parish of St. Botolph's, which is now in the city of London. What you can see is that something like 40% of deaths were occurring in the first 5 years of life, mostly by childbirth or infections in the first year or two of life. But even if you discount that population, the most common age to die was in your 20s or 30s. So it's sometimes thought that because infant mortality was so high, that in fact once you survived childhood, then you had a good chance of surviving to old age. But this and many other things shows that is not true. Only 5% of people were surviving beyond the age of 70. So old people were certainly existed at this time, but they were relatively rare. If in contrast we look at the population of England and Wales in 1998, 75% of people are surviving beyond the age of 70. So old age or very old age existed in the past, but it was much, much rarer. So people used to die young, now they die old. And people used to die from relatively acute causes. They used to die relatively quickly because people used to die from very large for infections, but also things like childbirth, heart attacks, accidents and violence, starvation, which are all nasty ways to die, but they're relatively quick compared to what people die from now. So the main causes of death, cancer, heart failure, stroke, COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And so this is just a plot of the main causes of death in the UK over the 20th century. And at the beginning of the 20th century, a large number of people were dying from infections or respiratory, basically respiratory infections. So this large peak is the flu epidemic after the First World War. And then towards the middle of the 20th century, you know, most people were dying from circulatory disease, which is basically stroke or heart disease or heart attack. But there was a dramatic decline in that in the second half of the 20th century. And that means that we die nowadays from things that kill you relatively slowly. And there's been a number of conversions of acute causes of death into chronic causes of disease. So, for example, heart attack has been converted to some extent to heart failure. So if we keep alive people who have a heart attack, that's something that used to kill you, if you keep that person alive, they tend to have an infarct in the heart, which can then go on to give you heart failure, which kills you relatively slowly. So we're converting an acute cause of death to a chronic cause of disease. Of course, these are fantastic triumphs, but they do have a downside. Similar conversion for stroke. Stroke used to kill you relatively quickly. There's been a massive change during the 20th century in survival rates for stroke and heart attacks. And those people, some of them go on to vascular dementia. Vascular dementia, in part, some of vascular dementia is just mini strokes. And again, there's many other examples, such as diabetes, which used to be an acute cause of death, has been converted into a chronic form of disease, HIV, death to HIV life. Many forms of cancer are now being converted to an acute form of death, from an acute form of death to a chronic disease. Which leads on to the idea that death may be switching in mode, or that our concept of death may need to change. So death may be switching from a digital mode to an analog mode. What do I mean by that? So an example of a digital device is a light switch. So you can have a digital light switch that is either on or off, or you can have a dimmer switch, which allows you to change the light continuously from fully on to fully off, anything in between. And we used to have a digital theory of life. That is, we used to have an idea of that we came into life from fully off to fully on at birth or conception. But we now accept an analog theory of coming into life. That is, we grow into life, into full consciousness, somewhere in between conception and childhood. We grow into life, so we have an analog theory of growing into life. However, we still have inherited a digital concept of death. We still tend to think that death is digital. That is, we're fully on until some event, and then death occurs and we're fully off. But that's a concept that has been inherited from the past, when, in fact, death was largely digital. It killed you relatively quickly. However, that's not the reality now. So in the past, death was almost digital, because people died rapidly when they were young. But in the future, death will be mostly analog, because people will die old, disabled, and demented. It sounds like a joke, but it's not actually a joke. So in the past, we have this digital concept of acute death, which is an event, but it may be the case that we're moving towards an analog form of death, which is chronic, so that instead of death being an event, it's a process merging with aging. So part one of the reflection of that is the comparison of life expectancy with healthy life expectancy. So this is the plot of life expectancy and healthy life expectancy in the UK between 1980 and 2000. And what you can see is that life expectancy is increasing at this incredible rate of between 2 and 2.5 years per decade, and there's no sign that it's slowing down. However, healthy life expectancy, that's life free of disease, is also increasing, so that's good news, but it's not increasing as rapidly as the increase in life expectancy, which means that there's an increase in the number of years lived with in ill health. So when this data came to consciousness of a variety of people, it caused some anxiety, obviously, for good reasons. But the way in which healthy life expectancy has been, there's been a redefinition of what, in fact, a healthy life expectancy is. So that's caused an increase in healthy life expectancy. So by redefinition, we've got an increase in healthy life expectancy. But it's difficult to now actually plot what is occurring in the terms of the UK. And it's contentious whether what the relative changes in healthy life expectancy, and there do appear to be different trends in different countries. Why might health expectancy, the amount of ill health be increasing as we increase our longevity? The obvious reason is that ill health increases with age. So there's a whole range of degenerative diseases which increase exponentially with age. Some diseases go down with age, some go up, but some of the more serious diseases increase with age. There may be some change in that, or drop off of that, over the age of 80 or 85, which may be some suggestion that physiology changes. Of course, it may be simply due to some survivorship. Those people who survive beyond the average may be non-average in terms of their genetics or environment in some way. Obviously, health declines with age, and this is just a plot of self-reported health at different age groups. So this is good health, this is fairly good health, and this would be poor health. Obviously, poor health increases with age. And multiple morbidities increase with age. So this is a plot of the percentage of remaining life at different ages with different conditions. There's an increase in very old age of multiple morbidities, so that chronic ill health being compounded with disability and dementia. Dementia, as I've said, is increasing quite dramatically. So these are the current figures. In fact, these are underestimates relative to the recent figures this year. But so there's thought to be about 800,000 people with dementia in this country, and it's expected to double or triple by 2050, simply because of the increase in longevity. It's not due to any change in the environment, but this predicted increase is simply due to an increase in the number of people living to greater age, and because there's an exponential dependence of the prevalence of dementia with age. So this is just a plot from Carol Brain's study, but this is a very large study, multi-centre study in the UK, taking a cohort of people from the age of 60 to 65, interviewing them every year, working out what percentage of them have dementia in the year before death. And there's very vaguely an exponential increase in the number of people dying of dementia with age. So, and they worked out that 30% of people over the age of 60 get dementia before they die. But if you extrapolate then that, so current life expectancy in this country is about 80. By 2050 it should be about 90, and that would put us in this region, so that something like 40 or 50% of people would be dying with dementia. That, if you think about it, is pretty scary. That means anybody under the age of 40 in the audience would be expecting to die around there. So we're putting the likelihood that you might die with dementia on the order of 40 to 50%. Of course. Now, it's a question of how important is that, and what are we doing about it? Well, currently the government puts in something like £30 million into dementia research. Are they doing anything? Are we doing anything to prevent that happening? No, we're doing absolutely the opposite. Even if there were no diseases of ageing, there would be an increase in dysfunction with age. There are many things that I could point out, but this is just memory impairment with age, and this is hearing impairment with age. And this is the dependency profile of elderly people by age. So different activities of daily living, such as shopping or cutting your nails or doing housework. So some of those decline dramatically with age, whereas others, such as being able to walk into the room, decline more slowly. So the question is, by eliminating acute death, we've enabled people to live long enough to die with chronic diseases, disability, and extreme ageing. So we may be in danger of extending life beyond what is beneficial or humane. So you may have heard of this idea of compression of morbidity. So this was a model based on the idea that humans had a maximum lifespan, and that as we remove the various diseases or causes of death, then we would compress morbidity as basically as average lifespan came up to maximum lifespan, morbidity would be compressed. And then there was the idea that there was no maximum lifespan, and therefore by removing causes of death, you would unreveal all these diseases, late life diseases, that have an exponential dependence on age, so you have expansion or morbidity. And whether morbidity is in fact expanding or contracting is still very contentious and seems to be different in different countries. And it partly depends how you define a healthy lifespan. But what I'd like to say is that the gap between lifespan and healthy lifespan, this morbidity gap, is something that needs to be compressed, that needs to be a goal of government. And it's as important, it should be as important to government as inflation, because it's fundamental to the health of the nation. It's not only fundamental to the health of the nation, it's fundamental to the economics of the nation. It underlies the pension gap and stagnation in many countries such as Japan. There are huge social and economic costs to that morbidity at the end of life. It was recently estimated by the University of Oxford, funded by the Alzheimer's Research Trust, that dementia alone costs the UK economy £23 billion a year, and that's now. That's going to increase dramatically. But only £50 billion is spent on dementia research, something like £30 million of that by the government. So what we need to do is compress that morbidity. No matter what the current trend is, we need to actively compress it. And one way to do that is to switch funding from preventing age-related death to age-related morbidity. We switched funding from simply funding causes of death to funding morbidity and disability and dementia at the end of life. Then we could compress morbidity. Now, it sounds like that's kind of utopian, or that would be very expensive. The exact opposite of the case. It would be enormously beneficial economically. It's the expansion of lifespan that is crippling the economy and will cripple the economy in the future. But if we compress morbidity, it would be massively beneficial to the economy. I think I'll miss that. So quality of life in the last few years of life is often the worst in life, and arguably is increasingly degenerative. And what I'm arguing is this situation is not natural, it's cultural. It's caused by certain funding investment decisions that were made in the past, and we're going to create those problems or solve those problems by thinking what we should be investing in now. And the end of life experience needs to change radically in many ways. It could do that, but I believe that hospices, for example, should be as well funded as maternity, and assisted dying is essential for some. Obviously, assisted dying is not the general solution to the problem, but it may be a solution for a very small percentage of the population. It seems to me ethically dubious that the society, if we accept this argument, I know it's a contentious argument, that extreme aging is not natural. It was created by our culture, by decisions in the past of our society. If we're creating hell for some people at the end of life, it's unethical not to give some escape route. So are we making the right decisions, funding decisions now? Well, most research funding is spent on causes of death, not causes of disease, disability, and dementia. So in red we here have had the percentage of these four diseases, percentage of total funding in the UK. And you know, the vast majority goes to cancer and to heart disease. Why is that? Is it because they're the main causes of disease? No, they're not the main causes of disease. So dementia and stroke contribute much more to years lived with disease than cancer. So dementia contributes five times as many years lived with disease as cancer. The reason that cancer gets funding is because it's a major contributor to death. So funding is related to the contribution of death, not to disease. It is not even related to the costs to society of those different diseases. Dementia is massively more costly to society than cancer. I'll just put in here that the cancer, although I've argued before that it's obviously a degenerative disease, but the point is that actually cancer is a horrible way to die, but actually it kills you on average relatively quickly compared to other diseases. So this is just a time course for some marker here, which is whether people have trouble getting in and out of bed at different months before death. So in cancer, you know, you have trouble getting out of bed in the time that you're, the month you're dying, but 6 months before you have relatively little problem. It kills you relatively quickly as compared to stroke or COPD or diabetes or chronic heart failure. So are these changes likely to occur? Well, we know that the previous government certainly targeted mortality to a much greater extent than morbidity. Is the present government likely to change? Well, it's difficult to know, obviously, but one indication is the Conservative Party's health white paper from 2008. So this was the idea of changing from process targets, which were a preoccupation of the Labour government, to health outcomes. But if we look at the seven targeted outcomes that the Conservative Party say that they're going to target in government, the first one is called cancer mortality, and then the stroke and heart disease mortality and lung disease mortality, healthcare-induced mortality, overall mortality. There's only one morbidity measure in there, and that's morbidity for heart and lung conditions. There's also patient dissatisfaction with healthcare. But the key aim was 100,000 extra lives for a focus on outcomes. The problem is, it's not just a question of quantity, it's also a question of quality. If you save an extra 100,000 lives and half of those are going to be demented, one has to think of what is your concept of death. Have we got the right concept of death? I think I'll skip this. Have we just about run out of time now?
About 5 minutes.
So that relates to the Tiphonus scenario. So Tiphonus was a Greek hero who fell in love with Eos, the goddess of the dawn, and Eos asked Zeus to grant Tiphonus immortality. And Zeus did that, but he omitted to also grant him, Tiphonus, the ability not to age. So Tiphonus aged infinitely, which was a bit of a problem for their love. And eventually Eos decided to turn Tiphonus into a cricket, which I don't really quite understand. Crickets were a symbol of immortality. But he turned into an apparently demented cricket. And the problem is that is what is threatening us. The increase in lifespan with unchanged aging leads to progressive enfeeblement, disease, disability, and dementia. And the decisions that we make now decide, you know, what our future is. Those of us under the age 40, which doesn't include me, luckily, have a potentially difficult old age. And you young people need to think about that now and influence government policy and healthcare policy to make it actually end of life, something worth living. So in conclusion, I told you the expansion of aging was caused by removing acute causes of death. And this has led to an expansion of morbidity, disability and dementia at the end of life. Lifespan is in danger of expanding beyond what is beneficial or humane. And we should stop funding research into causes of premature death and instead fund research into the causes of aging and age-related diseases and disability. That's it. Thank you.